loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Nicole Roussel, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we'll take a look at the biggest stories so far this week in our regular segment called In the News, including the government shutdown and the attack on Angela Davis over her support for the BDS movement. And then we continue our regular Wednesday segment Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump's Oval Office speech last night calling for $5 billion to construct a wall along the border with Mexico apparently did nothing to bring politicians on Capitol Hill any closer together. Meanwhile, with no end in sight to the government shutdown, Republicans in both the House and the Senate are beginning to break away from the president. Next, teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District are set to go on strike tomorrow after years of frustration over class sizes, salaries, and a shortage of nurses and school counselors. The district has made several offers, but the teachers' union says they don't go far enough. So barring a last-minute deal, 32,000 teachers will walk off the job tomorrow. Then, newly declassified information suggests that CIA Director Gina Haspel was in charge of a secret CIA facility at Guantanamo Bay, a site notorious around the world for torture of detainees. If true, the revelation shows a much deeper involvement in CIA torture than Haspel has so far admitted to. And then, attorneys for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort made a critical error yesterday when they filed motions in federal court and accidentally revealed that Manafort had met in 2016 with Konstantin Kilimnik and passed him polling data. But once again, crucial details are being left out of the mainstream media narrative. And finally, states and localities across the country are expanding healthcare access to their residents, despite the fact that Republicans at the federal level are still seeking to weaken or to do away with the Affordable Care Act. Single-payer healthcare is widely popular, but what is the best way to go about achieving it? And in other headlines, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a surprise visit to Iraq today. While in the country, he met with Iraq's prime minister, president, speaker of the parliament, and foreign minister. Pompeo's on a tour of Middle Eastern countries where he's expected to focus on promoting the U.S. campaign to isolate and sanction Iran. President Trump threatened today to cut off FEMA support for California, which is recovering from historic wildfires. He wrote, quote, "Unless they get their act together, which is unlikely, I have ordered FEMA to send no more money," unquote. Trump criticized California's state government for ineffective forest management, but many believe the main cause of the wildfires was in fact climate change. The British Parliament has begun its debate leading up to the vote on the Brexit deal, and Prime Minister Theresa May's government has already suffered a setback. Members of Parliament voted in favor of a motion giving May just 3 days to formulate an alternative if the Brexit deal is rejected. Fears are growing that a deal will not be approved by the March 29th deadline. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our weekly Wednesday segment In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman here in the studio. She is the editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube on Thursday nights. And we're joined in studio as well by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, y'all.
Happy to be here.
Glad to be here.
So we had a massive, very exciting, huge development last night, right? Trump gave this huge speech. He was going to, well, government's already shut down, but he was going to further shut everything down and make it a national emergency, right?
That was the threat.
What happened?
He walked back from his threat.
You know, we were talking a little bit before this meeting. He looked, you know, relatively normal. He looked relatively strong. He, as always, is a, you know, decent and persuasive talker, even if he sometimes says weird things, but he, you know, he was a good politician on the TV. And then we turned to Schumer and Pelosi, who looked like these very stern mother and father figures. I saw someone on Twitter who said, you know, when you're late getting home and you're a teenager, right, and the parents are there to get, you better get to bed. I don't know what you were doing up late. I mean, this was such a strange image. What happened last night, Walter?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. And I mean, I do think that Trump actually ended up coming off looking strong, at least, or that, you know, the weeks of pressure over the course of the shutdown so far, 2.5 weeks of pressure over the course of the shutdown, hasn't seemed to damage his resolve to just like keep it going, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is actually the only person who's talking about like a substantive issue of political principle, even though it's a completely wrong political principle of, you know, keeping out immigrants. Because, you know, I think the Democrat response is basically like Trump is an irresponsible and bad manager for using this particular tactic. And that's sort of like the end of their argument. And of course, you know, it is true that he's a bad and irresponsible manager because, you know, so many federal employees are suffering. But if there is a bigger issue of political principle that they were putting forward, if they were saying, no, this is ridiculous. You know, immigrants aren't the problem. The people on Wall Street are the reason why, you know, people might be suffering across the country. You know, people who might be susceptible to this kind of xenophobic rhetoric. There's a clear case that you can make that can like appeal to a lot of people. But they're not doing that. They're doing sort of, you know, their standard thing, which is like, you know, a highly technical critique of like the form of governance or the form in which the policy is packaged as opposed to like the policy itself.
Yeah. And the other problem is that as far as, you know, substantive issues they could address, they rarely ever, and this is the Democratic Party in general, they rarely ever address any of the lies Donald Trump tells in anything he says. And this, I mean, it was 9 minutes of my life that sadly I cannot get back. It was very painful 9 minutes to sit there and watch him lie the way he did this whole thing about, you know, a terrorist intercepted at the southern border. That's not true. But there have been suspected people intercepted at the Canadian border. And it's very interesting that we're not calling for a wall between us and Canada. And then there's the ridiculous issue of trying to tie the heroin opioid crisis with the immigrant non-crisis at the border, when the fact of the matter is most of the illegal drugs that come into this country come through checkpoints, through legal border crossing checkpoints, through vehicles, and also by plane and through shipping ports. In addition to, which is something that nobody ever mentions, at least the Democrats, tunnels in between Mexico and the United States. So this whole idea of a wall to keep drugs out of the country is ridiculous. And that was, like you said, Walter, it would have been an easy substantive argument to make. But the Democrats, Pelosi and Schumer, just stood there and they were the disappointed parents. You know?
and the pharmaceutical companies, too. I mean, like so many of the drugs are like, it's actually just legal, you know?
Very true.
Yeah.
I think one thing, too, that really takes the argument, any argument out of Schumer's mouth is that he's, as you know, as recently as the late November, November 28th, he was totally willing to give over $1 billion for the border. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for him to stand there and say, like, borders don't work, walls don't work, fences don't work. We, you know, should be doing something different. We should be doing something different with our money, when he was totally ready to do this. And a year ago, I was looking at news articles from pretty much a year ago. It's the same debate. Schumer and Trump were having the same debate. And Schumer was willing to go all in as long as we could get DACA. And
Yes. So
we're not talking about DACA. He has no argument for the wall. It's completely outrageous.
Yeah, on both sides. And I'm sorry I said that, because that just reminds me of there are good people on both sides. But on both sides of this argument, it's all political posturing. Neither one of these groups of people are sincere about addressing any real issues, especially in this discussion of quote unquote illegal immigration. I mean, if they're really concerned about people being here in an undocumented status, then they would check those visa overstays, nearly 600,000 visa overstays last year. But they were from primarily European countries. So I guess we're OK with those undocumented immigrants, but not the brown ones coming from across the southern border.
And not the ones where you can win political points by shooting,
That too. So, I mean, this is all just political theater on both political parties. And sadly, federal workers and the American people are being held hostage by all of these people so they can score political points.
I mean, we've seen more government shutdowns, increasing amounts of government shutdowns, this political game that ends in like closing down the thing we're fighting over, which just, I mean, it's not a way to actually govern. Walter, does this happen in other places? Like, is this a a political tool in other places?
No, I think the United States is pretty unique in the sense that this has become, but even in the context of U.S. politics, I think it's interesting in terms of, you know, like there were three shutdowns last year, right? Even though one was just sort of like a technical one. But, you know, the fact that this is becoming a more and more commonly used tactic in the United States, I mean, let alone in the rest of the world, is more or less unheard of. But it sort of shows that like the stakes are a little bit higher, you know, now in the political context of the United States, because, you know, like the security of the establishment, political economic establishment is actually, you know, it's not as secure as it was in, say, like the 1990s when there was no real, on the international stage, no real rivals to the United States. Internally, you know, much less dissent and inequality and, you know, all of that. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of reflective. And as a consequence, that's sort of reflected in the political elite, because, you know, the remedies for these, you know, pretty serious problems, there's a lot of divergence, you know, as the problems get more serious. When the problems are small, like they were in, say, the 90s for the elite, you know, you get things like Bush versus Gore in 2000, where there's sort of no difference at all. But now there is differences. And so they're going to be using more and more hardline tactics like government shutdowns. I think that's sort of the big picture of why this is becoming more common.
You know, there are starting to be breaks within the Republicans, not just in the Senate. We heard yesterday that Senator Murkowski is calling for a vote on the budget. We heard that Senator Collins is calling for a vote. But now on the House side, you're getting Republicans in endangered districts like Will Hurd of Texas, who has the longest district in America that stretches along the border with Mexico. That's Texas's 23rd district, saying that it's not fair to say that there is a crisis along the border if you don't want to pay the people who are handling the crisis for you. And so he's breaking as well. Clyburn said this morning, this is the House Majority Whip, he is now, said this morning that we are perhaps only days away from the end of this thing, and it's because the Republicans are falling apart. The whole thing rests on Mitch McConnell, because if Mitch McConnell calls a vote, it's going to be practically unanimous to put people back to work.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, though, as I was listening to both you, John, and you, Walter, talk about the politics of all of this, of shutting down the government. In other countries, the citizens shut down the government.
Yeah.
But in other countries, the people, when they're mad at their government and they don't think their government is serving their interests, they will take to the streets. In most other countries, I won't say all, but in a lot of other countries, the citizens will take to the streets and shut down the government until the government gives the people what the people
want.
That's
what happened in Australia. They had one government shutdown in 1986. People rioted in the streets and they never had a shutdown again.
Yeah.
And don't forget, our shutdowns used to be kind of bogus shutdowns. They would shut down at midnight on a Friday,
right,
and then everybody would be back to work on Monday.
Right.
And we were like, oh my God, the government was shut down over the weekend. It's not like that anymore. That was, We could call that a gentleman's shutdown.
Yes.
We don't have those anymore.
Yeah. So now we have the politicians in both parties in this country shutting down the government and punishing the people to get what the politicians want.
That's right.
It's a mess.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Like right now in India, there are 200 million workers on strike.
Yes.
So yeah, like that kind of, you know, so people are taking it upon themselves to shut everything down. Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting point.
We just have the managers of the government. They don't want to manage.
It's a manager strike. Is that what you're saying?
Maybe that's what I'm saying, but they're still getting paid, so I don't really know.
So, yeah.
Well, let's switch topics. You know, this week there was a coup in Gabon. I'd love to hear, Jackie, a little bit more about this. I don't know much about the region and would love to hear more about what's going on.
So the really interesting thing about this story is that, first of all, people have no idea that, you know, outside of Africa, have no idea that Gabon, it even exists. But Gabon is one of those countries that was colonized by France. And they are a part of this French strategy called France-Afrique, where France continues to prop up puppet leaders in their former colonies so that France can continue to profit from the resources in those regions. What's the resource in that region? Oil. So interestingly enough, the United States sent troops. We're not talking about hundreds of thousands. We're talking about like less than 100, maybe 80 troops with some airplanes to Gabon under the illusion that they are positioning themselves just in case violence breaks out in the neighboring Congo because of the election that has gone on there for like almost a month that is just dragged out and there are all kinds of problems. But suddenly, incidentally, coincidentally, a coup breaks out in Gabon when the United States military goes in, supposedly waiting for perhaps some violence to break out in the Congo. Why is that important? Because the family that has governed in support of France, for the interest of France, for like two or three decades, is about to appoint another leader that is friendly to French interests. And the people of Gabon are like, no, we're just sick of this. We're tired of being beholden to France. The military tried to take over, and apparently that didn't work out. But it's interesting the things that happens when the United States sends troops in and all of a sudden coups happen. That's very bizarre.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing that's underappreciated in the United States, that, you know, there really is this like neocolonial order that still exists in Africa, especially. Also in Niger, you know, France, especially under the president that came before Macron, the current president, Hollande, he went on like a warpath throughout West Africa. So in 2010, I think they invaded Ivory Coast, right? There was like a disputed election, and France was just like, okay, I think our army will undispute this, right? And then there was the 2011 French-led military intervention in Mali, and then in 2011 in Libya. Mali might have been 2012. The Central African Republic was invaded by France in 2013. So yeah, I mean, they totally meddle on a regular basis. And Niger, I think, is interesting because the French electric grid depends primarily on nuclear energy. And Niger, which is a former French colony, is the principal source of uranium that powers those nuclear plants. So yeah, there's this whole like complex neocolonial order in large parts of Africa. And yeah, France is one of the worst defenders.
I mean, I think that broadly people understand in America, in North America, I think, you know, that there was colonialism in the past, right? I think broadly people understand that France did a great deal of damage to the continent of Africa and in specific places, you know, throughout that continent, and that there were other European colonizers as well. But it's just, it's absolutely continued. And I think people don't understand that. I mean, even as, you know, recently as just a couple of years ago, but it's continued through that whole time period, right? When you look back to World War II, and we know that the person who came in right after Mussolini, who was also deeply unpopular, was the actual guy who finally defeated everyone in Ethiopia, who completely colonized it. I mean, but, you know, Mussolini ordered him to go and you know, try to colonize it. He successfully did it by requesting from Mussolini the use of mustard gas, which he was able to get, was able to use, and then was able to conquer the entire country with. You know, and then, but we still have, you know, this colonization up until now. It's still going on, and I think people don't know about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's neocolonialism through not just government military intervention, but also multinational global corporations, mostly energy corporations, and a lot of mining operations is basically how former colonizing nations continue to have a stranglehold on a lot of African nations. And unfortunately, they do that with help from some African leaders who are just as happy to cash a big fat paycheck and keep their people impoverished. So, you know, you'll always find collaborators within every group of oppressed people. That's just true across the board. We saw that in World War II. We saw that in every conflict where a stronger military or a stronger nation goes in and tries to invade and or take over another group of people. So collaborators is not unusual. It's just that, like you said, Nicole, that colonialism on the continent of Africa has never, ever ended. It just became possible through corporations.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think we should move to another topic. There's this really interesting and really terrible thing that's going on where the Fred Shuttlesworth Human Rights Award is supposed to honor the civil rights legacy, supposed to honor people, leaders in the civil rights community and the human rights community. And they aptly selected activist Angela Davis, who's been incredibly important and a leader, a visionary on a lot of things, specifically prison reform and prison abolition more specifically. And so in October, the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, their board announced that they were going to give this award to, again, this visionary, Angela Davis. But we're getting reports now that they are canceling it because Her statements and public record, quote, do not meet all of the criteria on which the award is based. What criteria are we talking about, Jackie?
We don't know. No one knows. No one knows what this criteria is because they have not released the criteria by which they rescinded the award. I think the mayor of Birmingham issued a statement basically saying the reason they rescinded this award was because there were some in the Jewish community who protested Angela Davis receiving the award, and they protested because of her longstanding support for advocating for freedom for the Palestinian people. There is no evidence that Angela Davis has ever said anything remotely anti-Semitic. I mean, she has never spoken out against Jews. She has been a consistent supporter of the right of Palestinian people for self-determination. Same thing that she supports for Black people.
It's a similar struggle, you might say. I think many people connect that those struggles.
It's a very similar struggle. And the BRIC has not been transparent in the exact reason for why they have rescinded this award. But she doesn't care. So she's concerned. She's upset. Her statement, I think she issued a statement saying that she was very shocked that the award was rescinded. But she's going to Birmingham anyway for an alternate award ceremony. So it's really difficult for activists in this climate where we're fighting both like this red smear 2019. It's 2019 now, but it started in 2016, 2017. This new red smear, red scare of Russiagate. At the same time, we're also fighting the very real influence of the nation state of Israel in speaking out against them.
And I think it's, you know, one thing that's a part of that is this conflagration of two issues, right? There is a real struggle going on in Palestine, and it is a real civil rights issue. And the fact that Angela Davis stands up for Palestinian rights is a reason that she should be getting this award. But that is not the same as anti-Semitism. And so often those two things are conflated, and they are very, very, very much different, right? The state of Israel and not supporting the state of Israel does not mean that someone is anti-Semitic. They are not supporting this colonizer state. They can and most often do still very much support the Jewish people, the Jewish voice. We have, you know, Jewish Voices for Peace, if not now, lots of organizations that I think make that really, really clear. But we're still in this age where those sorts of smears are happening. Davis, I wanted to read one thing that Davis said. She said, "This seemed particularly unfortunate, given that my own freedom was secured and indeed my life was saved by a vast international movement." I mean, she has got, you know, she goes on to say that she has devoted a lot of her time to linking struggles in other parts of the world to U.S. grassroots campaigns against police violence, the prison industrial complex, and racism more broadly. So she's doing exactly what we're talking about, right? She's connecting all of the civil rights struggles globally, and that's part of the work she's done. So the fact that this organization is picking one thing, changing it around, and using that as a reason not to give her the award is absolutely atrocious.
Can I add something to that, too? We're not the only ones who think this is a ridiculous travesty. The Thomas Merton Center, this is the Catholic Peace Organization in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, announced today that they are going to give Angela Davis their Thomas Merton Award because of what happened. They recognize, just like we do, that she deserves to be recognized. You started, Nicole, by saying that she's been a leading voice for a long time on prison abolition. This is a half a century we're talking about. She's been doing this for half a century, mm-hmm. and her message has been consistent that entire time.
Walter, I mean, it definitely is a part of something broader and rings really similar to what happened to Mark Lamont Hill. Do you want to compare those two things?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think it's fundamentally the same thing, right? I mean, so it was very powerful interests who, you know, are supportive of the state of Israel and all, you know, the horrible oppression that emits out to the Palestinian people, basically launching a coordinated attack against like a prominent radical Black activist. You know, Mark Lamont Hill is a well-respected political commentator, scholar, author. You know, and Angela Davis, of course, has this unbelievable track record. She's, I mean, one of the most famous activists in the world. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely part of a pattern. But I think that pattern is motivated primarily by like the supporters of Israel being so aggressive because they're in a weakened position in terms of public opinion. You know, it's becoming more and more of a partisan issue, I think, in U.S. politics, in large part because of just how extreme and right-wing the Israeli government has become under Benjamin Netanyahu. So, you know, now it's sort of like a little bit of the taboo is lifting, like it's okay to be, you know, say critical things about Israel. And then among young people, including and maybe especially among Jewish young people, you know, there's, you know, just growing recognition that this is an issue of about like fundamental human rights and self-determination.
This is for either of you, but, you know, it's starting to seem like it's a specific attack on the Black community. It's also more broadly, though, been on the left. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is another great example. I mean, where is this? Is this, like you said, just because Israel recognizes that its stance is weakening?
I think there's that because there is a growing opposition to the policies of the state of Israel in regard to the Palestinian people, and not just the Palestinian people, the migrants from African nations also. So there is more exposure to the racism that is a part of Israel of the policies of the Israel government toward non-European descended Jewish people. I know that's a very unpopular thing to say, but that's the crux of this entire issue that people in the United States and around the world, Black Lives Matter, other Black activists have always had with the way the government of Israel, the policies of the nation state of Israel, not the people, have treated people who they consider not like them. So it's very much like what we experience here, we meaning Black people.
That was the voice of Jackie Lukman. She's the editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Nicole Roussel.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined here in studio by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's great to have you back in studio. I know you've been traveling all over the country doing the important work of trying to end the nuclear waste industry and the nuclear industry as a whole. Do you want to start by telling us about how nuclear has been affected by the government shutdown?
Well, I focus on radioactive waste issues in my work, and this is not the first time that radioactive waste issues in this country have been impacted by federal government shutdowns. So at the present time, what just came out is that the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that is about to hear our oral arguments out in New Mexico is now having to scramble to find a new location for the hearings to take place in Albuquerque on January 23 and 24 because the U.S. courthouse where it was going to be is probably going to be closed, or it might be still. So it just hits me as so ironic because this happened in 2013 as well during the Obama years, a government shutdown over trying to repeal Obamacare at the time that went on for some time. And what happened was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was hosting public comment meetings on what they call continued storage of spent nuclear fuel, what they used to call their nuclear waste confidence decision, which we dubbed the Nuke Waste Con Game, and they had to change the name to Continued Storage. And they had to postpone meetings all over the country and then reschedule them after the government came back up. And it just shows that institutional control on radioactive waste can be lost here and now, not 100 years ago, 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, or 1,000,000 years from now, but now. And there's actually much more serious examples of this where there's a GAO, Government Accountability Office report, about highly radioactive waste that has been lost in this country. And one case was Vermont Yankee, where it probably got shipped out a fragment of irradiated nuclear fuel mistaken as a control rod from the reactor core, which would still have been highly radioactive, but this was irradiated nuclear fuel. And it probably got shipped to Barnwell, South Carolina, and buried in a leaking ditch in an African-American community. That's their spin on it. That's probably where it went. They really don't know. But probably that's where it went. And there's other cases like that. So a colleague of mine, Dave Lockbaum, who used to work at Union of Concerned Scientists, he was joking. He said, we have to open Yucca Mountain, Nevada immediately before we lose all the high-level radioactive waste. because he opposes Yakutu. So
funny, but also really depressing. I mean, this is yet another in the long line of examples and reasons why, you know, there is human error in the world. We cannot get rid of that. But that means that we cannot have so much, you know, incredibly dangerous waste. That's just, we just cannot do that because we will inevitably lose it. It will inevitably, you know, get into communities that it should not be anywhere near. It is just not something that we should be trafficking in.
Yeah. Humans are funny critters. And I've said this quote from Einstein on the show before, 1946. It was in the context of nuclear weapons, atomic bombs at the time, because we didn't really have nuclear power yet. But he said, the splitting of the atom has changed everything except for the way that we think. And thus we drift toward unparalleled catastrophe. And you can see it all the time in the nuclear power industry, shortcuts, just absurd stuff. So it's human beings being human beings, right? And again, Union of Concerned Scientists, Lockbaum's predecessor, an NRC whistleblower actually named Bob Pollard, caught wind of a file at NRC called the Nugget File. That's exactly what it was called. A senior safety officer named Hanauer at NRC back in the early days, the 60s, 70s, was keeping a file called the Nugget File, and UCS FOIA'd the Nugget File and they got it. And what it was a collection of the most absurd nuclear accidents you can imagine that had never been made public because it was too much, right? But this guy in his quirky sense of humor was keeping this file for whatever reason because he found it interesting. And one of my favorites was it involved a basketball. There's actually nuclear basketball stories. So they had a leak in a pipe coming off of the high-level radioactive waste storage pool. And this is serious stuff. You can have a fire if you lose the water. And they had a leak. And so what they did is they needed to plug this pipe so that they could work on this leak upstream. And they couldn't figure out how to plug it. So what they did is they took a basketball and they wrapped a deflated basketball and they inflated it a little bit, wrapped it in duct tape, and then inflated it enough to fit in the pipe they're trying to block. And they hadn't really done the math because these pools are 40 feet deep and very large. And the water pressure was too much for this basketball. It comes rocketing out with a flood of, you know, radioactively contaminated water behind it. They eventually get the situation under control. But if they hadn't, if they had drained the pool through this stupidity, well, the fuel will begin to heat up quickly, and it would melt. It would reach the ignition temperature of the zirconium metal cladding on the fuel rods, and then forget about it. There's nothing you can do because it's like sparklers burning down. It's going to burn the entire fuel rod. These pools are in warehouse buildings, industrial warehouse buildings. They're not in nuclear containment structures like the reactor. All that radioactivity in that pool would have escaped into the environment and probably taken out a state, depending on which way the wind was blowing. So that was one of the stories in the Nugget File.
Is that Nugget File out there now that it's been FOIA'd?
It's out of print, but he did a book.
Oh, boy.
Pollard at UCS did a book called The Nugget File that was, you know, a classic and a primer for the anti-nuclear movement. You got to read this book and, you know, make use of it.
Was this MacGyver or were these like trained agents or not agents, but trained officials who were supposed to be able to deal with it? I mean, that's just outrageous.
It's like using bubblegum to plug a leak.
And then Lockbaum did a follow up on the Nugget File called Fission Stories, like fishing stories, and just did updates, you know, since he came on board.
That is really overwhelmingly outrageous. Kevin, your maybe favorite senator, U.S. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, has been featured in the New York Times Magazine after 32 years in Congress. Do you want to tell us about his legacy?
Yeah. What I hadn't known was that he has terminal pancreatic cancer. And so he did this interview with the New York Times Magazine where he did go after Trump, called him the worst president ever. I guess he updated his status because he used to say that about George W. Bush, but now it's Trump. And so Harry Reid was a rookie senator when the Screw Nevada bill was passed in Congress. This was the bill that singled out Yucca Mountain, Nevada as the only site in the country to be further studied for a high-level radioactive waste dump. And they messed with the wrong rookie senator is what they did. He devoted the rest of his career to stopping the dump. I mean, he did a lot of other things, but one of his top priorities was stopping the Yucca dump. And the way he did that was, you know, he eventually became assistant Democratic leader in the Senate. Then he became Democratic leader in the Senate. Then he became majority leader in the Senate. What he was able to do was to keep his caucus somewhat in check, but he could cut off the funding for Yucca. And he did that throughout the George W. Bush years. We weren't able to stop it on the Senate floor in 2002. It was on July 9th. It was a big day. And the Senate voted by a vote of 60-39 to override Nevada's veto of the Yucca dump. So it's the best we ever did, 39 votes against. And Reid led that effort. We helped at the grassroots across the country because of the mobile Chernobyl issue. It's everybody's problem. It's just not Nevada's problem. And it was enough, though, to get Reid, you know, into his position of power in the Democratic Senate. He was able to mess with the funding year after year. I mean, Bush wanted to spend $2.5 billion per year at Yucca to establish facts on the ground, get it done. Reid was able to lower that significantly to more like the $400 million level. And we still wasted, you know, over $10 billion at Yucca. But it was by the skin of our teeth that we missed that radioactive bullet, because what it enabled was Obama to become president and work with Reid to kill the dump. And Obama agreed with the zeroing out of the funding. He ordered his Department of Energy to withdraw the license application. This was all back in 2010. So this was, you know, a tremendous victory for Harry Reid that he fought for decades on end. And he turned to environmental groups across the country on the mobile Chernobyl issue to help pressure others in the Senate to see it was their problem too.
And on your website, Beyond Nuclear, you've written up a little bit about this, and but you've noted that this New York Times Magazine profile, of course, does not mention this, you know, immense achievement that he has had. Maybe one of his more, I would say, one of his more important pieces of work, one of the things he's been most consistent on, does not mention that at all, right?
Certainly back home in Nevada, where it is a huge issue in the state, they don't want to be the nuclear dump for the country because guess what? They already took one for the team from nuclear weapons testing. A lot of people have died from cancer out there. So most families in Nevada know somebody or even have somebody in their family or themselves have suffered cancer. And Utah, too, next door. And Harry Reid's a Mormon. Another, I didn't put it in my write-up on the Yucca Mountain section of our website yet, but Harry Reid played a huge role in stopping the Utah Centralized Interim Storage Facility. It took a lot of effort, but got the Republican senators from Utah, Hatch and Bennett at the time, Hatch just retiring now, to stop promoting the Yucca dump if they wanted his help in stopping the centralized interim storage facility targeted at the Skull Valley Goshutes Indian Reservation in Utah. And finally, at the last possible second, they saw the light. They said, okay, we're changing our position on Yucca. And that dump in Utah was stopped with the help of the Democratic leader of the U.S. Senate. So it was, I told their offices every chance I had that you either hang together or you hang separately on this issue. Because, you know, the Southwest is seen as a nuclear wasteland by the rest of the country. At least the political rest of the country.
Speaking of a waste of money, there's good news, though. The Federal Appeals Court in Richmond just issued a final ruling allowing the Department of Energy's termination of the MOX project to go through. So this will essentially stop this massive waste of money in South Carolina. Beyond Nuclear, I think, has been involved in this for a long time. I'm sure you all told them, you know, before they've wasted $5 billion of taxpayer money, that they should just not do this? Is that right? Am I getting that right?
Well, the groups that really deserve the credit are groups like Savannah Riverside Watch, let's see, Nuclear Watch South. These are groups, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, Sierra Club of South Carolina. These are the groups, Women's Action for New Directions in Atlanta, who've been watchdogging the MOX fuel fabrication facility at Savannah Riverside for many years now. I mean, it really goes back to the Clinton administration. And yeah, I was fighting it in Michigan as a grassroots volunteer in the anti-nuclear movement. We had one of the first lawsuits in the country up there, Don't Waste Michigan, trying to stop this MOX program from beginning in the first place. And, you know, we did tell them so. We told them this was a bad idea. What they're trying to do was to take weapons-grade plutonium excess to U.S. military needs and turn it into fuel for reactors. And really, it was a huge subsidy to the nuclear establishment. It was, you know, actually somebody made that $5 billion just now. It's a waste to the U.S. Treasury, yes, because nothing was accomplished. But companies involved made that money, right? And so it turns out to be one of the biggest boondoggles in Department of Energy history. It was a relatively small project for the DOE, but in terms of the over-budget nature of it, it was one of the worst. And it was so bad that the Trump DOE is the one who canceled it. That's who got this cancellation done over the head of U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, who was its biggest champion. So when you hear Lindsey Graham on TV news every night, remember some of these stories about what he's done to the U.S. Treasury to support companies back home, workers back home, just a really bad idea. And they can't ever let go. And so now that MOX has been canceled, thankfully, after 25 years of struggle to try to get it canceled, they have another really bad idea to replace it with, and that is to turn the weapons-grade plutonium not into reactor fuel, but into weapons. So they've proposed to either build more nuclear weapons plutonium pits at Los Alamos, New Mexico. They'd ship the plutonium out there. Or they could do it right there at Savannah River Site in the facility that's been abandoned from the MOX project, for which it was not designed. They'd have to completely redesign it. They'd probably, it'd be smarter, wiser, cheaper to knock the building down and start over. But making weapons out of this plutonium was the opposite of the point. So it just shows the insanity of it all. And what we've said for 25 plus years is it's unfortunate this plutonium got made in the first place. Now that it exists, it needs to be treated as the deadly waste that it is, mixed back in with the high-level radioactive waste from which it came out of, and disposed of in a deep geologic repository that meets criteria like scientific suitability, isolation from the environment, consent-based siting, environmental justice. That's not on the table, even for the Trump DOE and Senator Graham.
It's dangerous. We have plenty of nuclear weapons. We should be getting rid of them, not making more. And so we should get rid of it in a safe way. Is that a good summary?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who is they, by the way? Who wants this plan to be done? We've canceled the MOX program, which was trying to reuse or, you know, provide some use for plutonium, even though we've all agreed in this room we should just treat it like waste like it is and get rid of it safely. But so this initial program was to use this plutonium for nuclear reactors as fuel. So that's been scrapped. The new plan, who's in favor of this new plan? I assume Lindsey Graham, because it could stay in South Carolina.
I'm not sure what Graham's position is. I haven't really studied what his position is on this particular issue. But the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is a part of the Department of Energy, and the Department of Energy, Energy Secretary Perry, President Trump, you know, they act on his behalf. They're pushing this. So it's a part of this bigger push to modernize the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. We're talking $1.7 trillion over 30 years, which was begun under Obama,
mm-hmm.
but Trump has continued it. And it's a part of that insanity. And groups like out in New Mexico, Nuclear Watch New Mexico, are fighting hard. Other groups too, like Greg Mello, who used to come on the show from a Los Alamos study group, and other groups out there are fighting this idea of making more pits at Los Alamos. Like you said, of course, we should be abolishing nuclear weapons. Instead, first the Obama administration with this modernization idea, and now, and to be fair, it's under pressure from the national nuclear labs like Los Alamos, who love the huge budgets that they get and the huge salaries that they're paid to do this kind of thing. They're the ones lobbying for it, and the weapons manufacturers, the corporations involved who are going to make all this money. So there's this, you know, it's Eisenhower's old warning about the military-industrial complex, only this is the nuclear military-industrial complex. And, you know, they lobby the Hill, they lobby Congress. The Savannah River Site is a huge employer in South Carolina, and that's what Lindsey Graham is answering to. I'm not saying it's a good thing, it's a bad thing. But that's what's going on. And so they have their representatives on the Hill in the form of Lindsey Graham, who do what they urge him to do. And that's why we're in the mess we're in.
I will note the Department of Energy during this partial shutdown is fully funded and operational, which I assume means all the labs are, the nuclear labs are also funded.
Yeah, they got that done earlier in the year. So it's just certain agencies like the EPA that are shut down almost entirely.
Sure. And I mean, you know, there are sections, of course, within the Department of Energy, like, you know, energy efficiency, renewable energy, that sort of thing, that are having trouble, I think, getting funding out to labs. But for sure, the nuclear departments, I feel confident, are doing what they need.
Interestingly, St. Louis, Missouri, the Westlake landfill, which is Manhattan Project waste, essentially from the 1940s, 1950s.
Which reminds you, it doesn't just go away after a while.
Well, the EPA under Pruitt, not many months back, had said, okay, we'll do a 70% cleanup, 70. We won't do 100%. People weren't real happy with that, 30% remaining behind. Well, guess what? EPA is shut down right now. So their monitoring, their oversight on the site is not happening right now. And I was just out there, and the Just Mom St. Louis, one of the main watchdogs on that contaminated site in the middle of their neighborhoods, was out there at 9 o'clock at night in the dark, in the cold, because this blue flame that's supposed to relieve the methane in the garbage dump next door that's on fire underground. That's one of the biggest risks to this radioactive waste, is this not so slowly encroaching fire underground that's going towards it. The blue flame that's supposed to relieve the methane pressure coming out of the garbage was not blue. It was yellow, and it was all over the place, and it was much bigger than it was supposed to be. So there was something going on, and there's no EPA there.
No one there to monitor but the moms organization?
Just Moms St. Louis. Yep. Moms with kids who live in the immediate vicinity of this radioactive waste.
I'm so relieved and happy that there is an organization out there doing that. It should be the people who are being paid to do that, who are the monitors, who are the people who are the watchdogs, the people supposed to be out there doing that.
There's a great documentary, the best, probably the best anti-nuke documentary I've seen, called Atomic Homefront, that just came out about a year ago, about the Westlake landfill, about Just Moms St. Louis and other groups in St. Louis, because there's contamination all over the metro area. Coldwater Creek, Just the Facts, is another group out there. And it's a really brilliant documentary about all these ordinary people who are forced to do this work because their kids are sick, mm-hmm. their parents are sick, they're sick, they want to know why, they found out why, and now they want this waste cleaned up after so many decades.
That's how so many, you know, of course, how many, so many grassroots movements get started, right? It's because of people who are affected and shouldn't be. And that's what actually makes change. We talk about that on the show sometimes, but it's the people who are actually affected by it who have to push and push and push and push and try to get something changed. And so we're so happy, Kevin, to have you on the show as part of that movement. Again, this is Kevin Camps, who joins us every Wednesday with Beyond Nuclear. He's the radioactive waste watchdog. Let's move on to some a little bit more positive news. Iowa is getting a $1 billion wind investment. This is fantastic.
Yeah, I was just out in Iowa in late October and driving between cities. I was on a speaking tour about radioactive waste transportation risks, and I hadn't seen wind turbines of such scale on land before. And wow. They're about to put them in off land on water on the East Coast, for example. They'll be even bigger out there, but these were monumental sized wind turbines being constructed as I drove past. Just the first level of the tower was being built out in the cornfields. And I was like, those are big. So those are going to be large scale generators of electricity. And what this is Mid-American, which is owned by Warren Buffett. Amazing story. A colleague of mine named Mike Carberry with Green State Solutions in Iowa organized a coalition, including ARP.
What is ARP?
The American Association of Retired Persons.
ARP.
And others who would be impacted by Warren Buffett and Mid-American's proposal a decade ago to build new reactors in Iowa under construction work in progress, which means by charging ratepayers on their electric bill to finance it. And Mike Carberry and his coalition he built, environmentalists, retired persons, low-income households, were able to stop it. And they beat Warren Buffett's lobbyists and Mid-American's lobbyists in the Iowa state legislature. The good news is that Mid-American immediately after their defeat on this, you know, nuclear bailout bill turned to wind, because Iowa, as Dr. Arjun Makajani at Institute for Energy and Environmental Research has pointed out for a long time, Iowa alone, its wind power potential could supply 20% of the electricity in the country, country, not the state. So Mid-American got it. And this news that just broke is they're going to invest. They've already invested hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more. Now they've just announced investing another $1 billion for wind turbines in Iowa.
And it's not, you know, over the next 10 years or 20 years. It looks like, you know, the project will actually be completed in the next under 2 years, actually.
That's why.
Somewhere in Iowa.
Yeah. Well, they keep it quiet because there are other industries, for one thing, who would like to sabotage these projects. So, you know, if they find out where it's going, they can rally locals to say, you know, these wind turbines are going to drive you crazy with their strobe effect. There's these really nut stories out there that public relations. Yeah. Scare tactics. And they drum up opposition. So it's really good news. And it shows, like you said, about the timing of it all, that renewables like wind and solar can get done quick. They do get done quickly, and nuclear takes decades to deploy. So if you have limited time and limited money, you should be investing it in energy efficiency, which is the lowest hanging fruit of climate solution, biggest bang for your buck, and then renewables like wind and solar that can get done quickly.
And is a good long-term investment, right? I mean, that'll be beneficial for years, decades.
And
even.
Creates jobs, creates tax revenues, and the farmers who host these wind turbines in their fields not only can continue to graze livestock or grow corn beneath the wind turbines, they also get paid money for hosting the turbines. And what would be really ideal, colleagues of mine like Harvey Wasserman with Solartopia point out, the most ideal situation would be if the farmers themselves could own the wind turbines on their land. if the financing were there to help them build what are, you know, a huge investment in the beginning, but then they pay themselves off quickly. But most farmers don't have that money to own the turbines, to build them themselves. But if that financing could be established, that would keep the American farmer on the land right there instead of, you know, energy companies doing it. Dr. Makajani takes the position that it has to get done. So if it's big companies like MidAmerican getting it done and paying some money to the farmers in a lease agreement, that that's acceptable too, because we have to solve the climate crisis.
Are you seeing a trend here? Are there other states? I mean, the figure you cited that we talked about last week in the renewables renaissance idea, you know, was 20% from one Great Plains state. And there are other states who I'm sure have similar wind capacity that we talked about last time. Are you seeing a trend? Are there other states who might start doing this, or other companies who might start really developing wind in other states?
There are examples. Minnesota's got some good wind going on. It's an interesting battle between nuclear and wind in Minnesota. Unfortunately, we really didn't think this was a great idea, but some groups did up there in Minnesota way back in the early 1990s as radioactive waste was being put into dry casks on an Indian reservation. There's a reactor. There's two reactors there, too. It's called the Prairie Island Indian Community. A compromise that was struck was for every dry cask filled with high-level radioactive waste against the will of the tribe. That was the problem. That was the problem. This was an environmental injustice, just like the reactors were in the first place.
Absolutely.
It's on an island in the Mississippi River that floods regularly, badly. And so these wastes should not be stored there.
Yeah, not safe.
So the compromise was every container that gets filled, $500,000 towards wind power. So it seems like a good thing, but the ones getting screwed were the Indian tribe. Because they have to live with the waste now. So
they have to live with the waste that's in a place that doesn't make sense to put it, right? And the only reason it's getting put there is because it's in an Indian reservation.
Yeah, the reactors were built against their will. The waste was in place there against their will. But there are other places where wind has been effectively sabotaged. Ohio, I keep mixing up the two states. Ohio, I saw Governor Kasich on the news last night. The Ohio Republicans have sabotaged wind for many long years on end. They require a set-off distance of 1,000 feet from a turbine for any structure. A tool shed cannot be within 1,000 feet of a turbine, which makes it nearly impossible mm-hmm. to build turbines. It's entirely on purpose. It's the coal burners and the atom splitters of Ohio, namely First Energy Nuclear, which also owns Beaver Valley in Pennsylvania, and they're doing the same thing in Pennsylvania. They're trying to sabotage wind. They're trying to sabotage solar, even though one of the biggest solar PV panel manufacturers in the country, First Solar, is just outside Toledo. So Ohio, they're sticking with the dinosaurs and sabotaging renewables.
I mean, this is one tool I really despise, this legislating by baseless regulation, right? I mean, you see it in abortion care as well. Like, well, your hallways have to be so big in a hospital to provide abortion care. If not, you can't do it, even though the hallway doesn't matter what size. It does not relevant at all. You see it in criminal justice, too. Like, if you're on parole, you have to live in certain places, but it can't be far away from some other certain places. So then you end up homeless because there's nowhere you can legally live. I mean, these are all completely baseless regulations. 1,000 foot for a set off point doesn't matter.
Ohio has some of the best wind potential in the country, especially in Lake Erie. But my attitude, I'm from Michigan, and my attitude for a long time has been until people get used to wind turbines on land, they're not going to be in favor of it on the water. Cleveland, under various administrations, locally, statewide, federally, have gotten some wind turbines on the lakeshore, not in the lake, but showing that it's possible. If you're at the Rock and Roll Museum in Cleveland, there's a wind turbine at the Science Center right next door, a big one. So there's tremendous potential on the lake, across Ohio, and so the fight goes on.
Well, the fight is also continuing in South Carolina in terms of solar energy. What's going on there? Is there actually going to be a solar energy revival?
Yeah, again, renewables against nuclear. And, we're in the aftermath of the cancellation of the summer units 2 and 3 nuclear power plant at a loss of $9 billion to South Carolina ratepayers. And so there was just an article in Clean Technica about the solar potential of South Carolina. There's some solar going on in South Carolina. There could be so much more. And it's an opportunity cost. If you're going to waste $9 billion on nuclear, you don't have that money anymore to invest in solar. So that was the point being made. And you know what's crazy about this stuff? Something I wanted to mention about Ohio was, guess where the first wind-generated electricity on Earth was generated and what year?
Was it Ohio?
Cleveland, Ohio in 1887.
What?
The inventor, Charles Brush, electrified his house with batteries, but it was wind-generated electricity that went into the batteries. He had artificial light in his house. That was in 1887. And solar, too. This new movie, Vice, has a part about Carter putting solar thermal on the White House only to have Reagan come in and tear it off as his first act of office. And an advisor to Beyond Nuclear, Steve Strong, with Solar Design Associates in Massachusetts, got contracted, interestingly, under the George W. Bush, who gets solar. He has solar at Crawford. They put solar on the pool area at the White House. And Steve Strong's joke was, we installed it very well. It's going to be really hard to tear out.
Yeah, right. It's going to have to be. I mean, hopefully Lindsey Graham could get behind this. If there are solar companies who want to build solar in South Carolina, wouldn't this be just as good of a company to get behind?
Some, like in Germany, again, Germany's going renewable and efficiency. They're phasing out nuclear. They're phasing out coal over time. Big companies like RWE and E.ON, the biggest electricity companies in Germany, they see the writing on the walls. They're getting out of nuclear. They're getting out of fossil fuels, and they're going renewable because they realize they're going to go extinct if they don't.
That's what we should be doing, too. This was the voice of Kevin Camps. He joins us every Wednesday in our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization called Beyond Nuclear. This is Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.